Stanford University. So I don't know if you've been there. It's stunning, beautiful. It's almost like the Vatican, but with swimming pools, okay? Blue sky every day, palm trees, I mean, gorgeous. I've done a lot of interviews with tech people there. They said that all the time that usually they are more at ease with computing stuff than with people. Let's be adventurous. Let's go to Burning Man. So I've been there. Don't go there. Don't let your children go there, at least.
Man hat sich diese Leute lange als harmlose Nerds vorgestellt. Ein bisschen zu viel Code, ein bisschen zu wenig Sonnenlicht, eher links, eher idealistisch. Das war vielleicht einmal. Heute geht es im Silicon Valley um Macht, um sehr viel Geld und um die Frage, welches Weltbild eigentlich hinter all dem steckt. Olivier Alexandre hat genau das untersucht. Er hat fast ein Jahrzehnt im Silicon Valley verbracht. Nicht als Fan, sondern als Beobachter. Sein Buch «Tech – When Silicon Valley Remakes the World» ist so etwas wie eine Innenansicht dieser Branche. Am AHA-Festival 2026 beantwortete er eine einfache und ziemlich große Frage. Was glauben diese Leute eigentlich? Hier ist sein Vortrag.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Christoph, for the invitation, the organization. It's a real pleasure and real honor to be here. I know that it's the last talk. I'm sorry about that. I bet you are pretty tired, so I will try to be entertaining. Plus, I'm really sorry, I don't speak Dutch. Plus, I'm French and I'm going to speak in English. And actually, I guess my accent is even worse than Emmanuel Macron is. So at least it's going to be fun. So dealing with the topic apparently is not a fun one, because the responsibility to explain how these guys, the tech bros, think and see the world. And actually it's not an easy task. The first challenge is that I'm a sociologist. I've been working on Silicon Valley and tech industry in the US for 10 years now. And so I see the same people and the same faces, but actually I saw the name had some changes through times. Because more than 10 years ago, we used to call them like super geeks. More recently, we started to get worried about them, seeing their kind of evolution in their behavior. And very early, we saw them like the real support of the administration Trump, which is definitely the return of a very authoritarian regime. To me, my hypothesis is that they are the same guys, they didn't have changed much through time, and I will try to explain you why. So I have a few material and details and about which is and are my perspectives through that topic. I use a lot of different material for speaking about tech. I try to sum it up like Christoph. He has been kindfully recalled this book, who has been published in the US this year. I think it's the worst timing ever for publishing a book about the relationship between tech and politics, for obvious reasons. I have colleagues right now in the US who don't dare anymore to use female gender climate, even in their email correspondence. So there is really something is happening right now in the US. And so what I try to do in the book is to articulate how tech is organized through space, but also how people work there, and finally, what are their spirit and mindset. And so in this talk tonight, I will try to focus on the last part of the book and trying to ask and answer a few questions, mostly three. What tech bros think about it? What and where do they think about? And how they think about it? So An important thing that I try really to repeat interview after interview is that Silicon Valley is a very complex whole and a very long story and very long history, maybe far longer than Hollywood if we want to compare to industries in California. So right now, and even at the moment that I speak, there are many people working in tech who are far beyond and far away from what is going on in Washington. The first ordeal, the first difficulty of the talk is to know what that means, tech bros. So I will try to propose you to do some exercise. Or it's going to be a game. I'm going to show you some pictures of, let's say, tech people through times, and you're going to try to observe and note the both similarities and the differences. Okay? You can do that. So let's start with them. It's the OpenAI team. I mean, part of it, because some of them have been cut off, but at least it was the early beginning, the team of OpenAI. But if we go like 10 years before, we have these guys, the Yahoo team, and 10 years before, we had the Yahoo team. And in the 80s, we had the Cisco team. And before that, of course, we had the Steve Jobs and his pal hacker who developed Apple One. But actually, Apple One has been possible because of these guys at Intel. And some historians would say that Intel has been maybe the milestone of tech and Silicon Valley history. But actually, if you look at the real history, 10 years before, they were at Fairchild. And even before, they were with Shockley, who was a very terrible guy, eugenist, racist, and a Nobel Prize. And actually, what is done in Silicon Valley has been possible because these two, Hewlett and Packard, maybe it reminds you something, and they were working during the World War II on some radar technology. And this tech and research have been possible because of them during the 20s working on the television signal. And if we go farther and farther like that, at the early beginning of the century, we had radio hobbyists. So, question now. What can you observe and what can you say about them? So, actually, I really hate this kind of show when you have to interact with the showman. I really hate that. You paid, I've been paid, so no. I will do the job. I will do the job. So, first thing first, I would say they work, everybody, all of these guys work in a small private companies. They also be located in North California. They were mostly men, with one exception. They were mostly white and pretty young. They were all engineers, well-trained engineers, went to Stanford, most of them. All very strong tech believers, and strong will be a light word for coining their belief in tech and how tech could be useful to the world. And especially, they think that the world is exactly their playground. They don't see like they could have an impact for their own community. They think that their real address should be the world. And another striking thing is that they are very different if we compare the different generation. I mean, the outfit, at least. But they are still the same. If you look at the group, there is this kind of uniformity. And actually, if you look at the tech and their companies, there is the same paradox. What I mean by that is that, of course, the companies have been super different. Of course, the tech services are super different. But actually, they have the same perspective, and they try to answer the same problem. And this problem is information. since the beginning. So in my work, it has been 10 years now, in my work, at some point, I started to be obsessed by this question. Why are they running like that after information and communication system? I mean, there are other things in life. So, hopefully. So what I try to do, and I don't say that it's the truth or the right thing to do, but what I try to do is to go back in time and trying to understand where does that come from, this eager to develop and the fact that they believe in information. So once again, I will ask you to do a kind of exercise. It's to put yourself in the shoes of the very beginning of Silicon Valley, I would say, during the Golden Rush, so mid-19th centuries. Try to imagine that you are an immigrant, a minor, you come from a different place in the US, but maybe it's a different place in the world. And usually you had like very bad experience in your life. You try to flee like war, or lack of food, or persecutions, things like that. And you go there, and you go there for having a very, very tough and challenging way of life. Basically, work all day long. And this is not something to be away from home, away from your friends, but also away from God. And for them, and I think it's a really important thing, for them, at some point, tech started to be their own gods. Because tech for these miners have been like a surviving and a really differentiating factor between the people who are going to like die and lose everything and people who are going to be rich. And I think coming from Europe, it's not nothing, because when I go, every time I go in California, in Silicon Valley, I can feel this tech optimism. But coming from Europe, I mean, we've been through wars, nuclear accidents, and especially the French, they are the most skeptical about AI in the world. We have this title as well. But there is quite the opposite. It's really the opposite. They are super optimistic about what technology can do. And if you look after the different moments and sequences of the history of Silicon Valley, you can find that. How communication and information has been always been a good news for them. And it started with boat communication, but after that, when farmers starting to be like the real economic growth of North Cal, it was the same thing. And for a long time, Silicon Valley was just orchards. It was about apricots, almonds, oranges, name it. And at this time, actually, all the country was about farming. We had half of the population, and more than that in the labor force, who were working in farms. And this is why also it has been super important to develop some both communication tools, but also information tools. And it was really something to develop when Union Pacific developed the first transcontinental railroad. And actually, if you look at the picture, it's kind of a mythology there in California. This event, the first time that they can cross the railroad in the country. And actually here, you can see a very important man in the history of Silicon Valley, maybe the most important one. And this man, I'm pretty sure you don't know his face, but you know his name. His name is Leland Stanford. And Leland Stanford had been many, many things in California history and his own life. He started as a lawyer. Then he lost everything. He went in San Francisco. He opened up a little boutique selling some gears to miners, which is starting to be, since then, a kind of mantra. People in Silicon Valley say, if you want to get rich, don't do things, but sell things to the ones who try to gold and finding some gold. And And after that, he had a lot of money, and so he started a business in railroad, and he has been, at the end, the CEO of the conglomerate in the US, a very important position. And then he started to be governor of California. And actually, this is a very fascinating character. I wish that Martin Scorsese shoot a movie on him, because it's really amazing. But here, the important part is that he was completely fascinated by technologies, especially technologies of communication and technology of information. He was fascinated by, for instance, photography and the first movies, the way how we can picture and control image, but also the speed and the light. And it wasn't just a simple curiosity, it was also a kind of professional interest, because he was in the railroad business. And to be in this business at that time, it wasn't like today. I mean, yesterday, for instance, I was super pissed off because I missed my connection in Basel, so I had to wait for an hour. And I was like, oh, gosh. But at that time, when you had hassles, it was real hassles. It was accidents, but it was also like to don't have some news of the train, because we didn't have even phone at that time. And remember, for farmers, to don't know where is your production, and maybe sometimes your production of the year, because it's stuck in a train where you don't know where it goes, it's really something. It's really, really something. So for these different reasons, they started to understand and to develop new way to communicate. Plus, there is another, I would say, tragic event in the life of Leland Stanford. Actually, he lost his son when this one was 16 only. It was a tragic event for all the family. It was his only son. And so he tried to make the best of it, meaning to create a school, a university, to qualify students for personal success and direct usefulness in life. Personal success and direct usefulness in life. I don't know what you think about that. I mean, I'm a father now, and honestly, I'm not sure that my deepest wish for them, my kids, is personal success and direct usefulness in life. I mean, it's a certain way to see life, and especially, I won't say that education, the first goal of education is that. But for him, there was no doubt about it. Plus, the second thing, and it's important for our story, is that he wants that this mission will serve the humanity, not only California, not only the US, but the whole humanity. And I mean, this is almost a joke. This gimmick in Silicon Valley to make the world a better place, to have an impact. I don't know if you know this HBO series, Silicon Valley. It's super famous, super popular in Silicon Valley, and people actually really say that all the time there. We want to make the world a better place. But it's not new, on the contrary. So my question, and it's not an easy one, because I have an answer, but it's a difficult question. My question at some point in my research was to understand how we've been gone from Leland Stanford to these gimmicks. Because Silicon Valley and tech is not about the past, it's not about history. I mean, every new entrepreneur, developers, or data analysts, usually, most of them, they even don't know the life of Leland Stanford. So there is a real mystery here. And this is the time where I have to speak about that. I mean, where do they think? And why it's important? I will follow Walter Benjamin, the philosopher, when he used to say that usually we're focusing on what people have in their minds, but we should pay more attention to architecture, what is surrounding us, because what's surrounding us have a deep influence on us. And actually, I tried to use this idea for understanding and describing Silicon Valley. And if we do that, you have to go back to Stanford University and to the campus. So I don't know if you've been there. It's stunning, beautiful. It's almost like the Vatican, but with swimming pools, okay? Blue sky every day, palm trees, I mean, gorgeous. Young people everywhere, hyper successful, hyper smart as well. I mean, it's like the paradise, really. And it has been built like that, with this idea. And a very interesting thing in this architecture is that, of course, you have the buildings there, the tower. I mean, they are all stunning, but actually the most important part is the empty space right there. It's what they call at Stanford the square. And the square had a function, a mission. The early idea of the architect was that when you go to Stanford, you have many people coming from all over the world, and they are super smart, super advanced in their own disciplines, but actually to have this empty space will allow them to cross their roads, to interact, to speak a bit, and doing that creates new things, think about new things, let works serendipity. And, I mean, it's a good idea, but what is extremely intriguing is how this architecture is, if we look at the empty space, the exact same idea and display at Googleplex. I mean, no connection to what I do, but no connection between the two architects. But still, if you go to the Googleplex, the inner center of the campus is this, a terrace with some chair, and the other one is the beach playground, the volley playground. And actually, if you look at the Meta campus, the same thing. Once again, at the middle of it, here, same idea. People have to let serendipity work for themselves. And Apple Park, quite different, but actually also the same, again. And let's be adventurous, let's go to Burning Man, again. So, I've been there, don't go there. Don't let your children go there, at least. But, I mean, why I'm saying that? Because it's really something. And the Burning Man is a key element in the Silicon Valley culture. Elon Musk used to say that Burning Man is the real spirit of Silicon Valley. So, of course, people will say that it's all about drugs, nude people, sex, and it happens. That's true. But it's more than that. And actually, the key element of Burning Man is that you have this kind of cycle. And again, the most important part is the empty space where people can, I mean, be adventurous. They call that the playa because it's a kind of playground. They can mix, they can exchange about all of different things. And actually, Silicon Valley used to be, and it's still the case, about very different kind of trends and tradition intellectually, philosophically, culturally. You have everything. You have, of course, and we spoke a lot about them, the singularists or the Dark Enlightenment, Peter Thiel, Curtis Yarvin. It's true. I mean, it's part of the valley culture. But you have also complete different things, like the hacker culture, the back-to-land culture, the queerness culture. And actually, through this different picture, we can see the basic architecture, but also the basic philosophy of Silicon Valley culture. And what is interesting in that experience is that when you go there, you have, at some point, do your kind of synthesis of this different current, which is a very strong experience. I mean, imagine being in the desert like for more than a week without sleep, with noise like all the time, with maybe drugs, and no strings attached. And what people say, coming back from Burning Man, is that at some point after 3 or 4 days, they're starting to let things go. They don't have masks or identity anymore. And through that process, they can act and think about whatever they want, and they also find the power and the will to realize what they want, which is really powerful and could be also super dangerous because you don't have check and balance anymore. You don't have control. And for some people, you don't pay attention to other ones surrounding you as well. So, it's the time, the third part of the presentation, when I have to say how they think. And actually, what I didn't say here is that if you want to live well in this area, in this environment, because actually it's not the typical sand, and you're not supposed to do that. It's super dangerous because the ground is alkaline, is super acid. So just after 7 seconds, you're going to have a burning skin all around. So it's real nightmare there. And for having a good life, you have to use tools, like real ones. And actually, it's not, hazardous that these people both use tools in their life, but also work on tools professionally. And I will refer to a very interesting book. It's a quite old one now, more than 40 years. It has been published by a psychologist, Sherry Turkel. She has been trained in Paris by Jacques Lacan. And after a PhD, she went back to Boston, and she started to work on AI community, late 70s, early 80s. It wasn't the AI hype at all. And she worked on them, and she said very, very important things, like that for these people, and they're coming from mathematics or informatics, they were hackers. For these people, computing wasn't just a tool. It was an extension of themselves, an extension of their consciousness. And it's really true. I mean, I've done a lot of interviews with tech people there, and they said that all the time that usually they are more at ease with computing stuff than with people. Or it could be also the physical world. I mean, tech is part of their world, and it's a super important part, to the point that they can make the difference. And so, once again, an important difficulty of my work was to represent this world, this technical dimension of their own mind. And so what can I show you is this kind of map. It's a network analysis based on what services have been financed in Silicon Valley through the last couple of years. And so, I mean, you can see that there is one big inner core software with AI, data analytics, these things. And we have many margins. It could go from clothing or health is not a margin, but I mean, it's a kind of totality. And tech is now tackle a lot of different activity, economic and cultural activity. But I think for understanding that, we just have to look at what they see, what they like, what they read, what they quote. And actually, when you do that, usually you go to science fiction, because science fiction for a lot of them are a kind of Bible. And I could speak about Matrix, but if I have to speak about Matrix, I will have to speak about The Neuromancer, the book published by William Gibson, which has been very influential for Peter Thiel, Reid Hoffman, or Elon Musk. And so I prefer to go to this movie, Tron. I don't know if you've seen it. I think there is a Disney franchise now. But actually, Tron is a really serious try to give an aesthetics to this tech mentality. It can be explained because Bonnie McBird was the screenwriter, and Bonnie McBird was the wife of Alan Kay. Alan Kay is an extremely important figure in the hacker community. And so I don't know if you remember the movie, but the movie is a kind of computer programmer who fights against a big tech company. And at some point, he figured out that the computer is the enemy of the company. And he finished in the computer, in the program. And so the movie is starting to be a quest where the hero have to fight against some programs and to find an escape. And actually, it's really a good picture of the mindset of tech people. And the only limit of that is that tech people are not on a grid, on a flat grid or flat ground, fighting other people, except Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. Actually, their real playground are the future. Their greed are the future. And you can clearly see that if you look at how big tech companies have been financed through times. And I've done that with Uber, I've done that with Tesla, I've done that also with Airbnb. Same form, same structure. I call that the financial staircase. You go slow and small with a lot of money, and you finish at the end usually with the money of Emiratis, Japanese, some funds international. And the logic of that is that actually the digital capitalism is a very bad market. Of course, you can win a lot of money, but you only win a lot of money if you are the winner of the competition. And at the early beginning of the competition, you have a lot of competition. And so you lose money, you raise money, you lose money, you raise money, you burn cash till you are at the top. But this way of thinking entails that for these people in tech, people who are serious about tech, they always think 10 years ahead because it's the span of it. They don't work. I mean, real people right now in Silicon Valley, they don't work on Gen AI anymore. It's finished. It's done. Listen to Yann LeCun. He said that. I mean, it has been a couple of years that he's saying that. And I think it's true because he's thinking about the what is going on in 10 years. And some people, even more serious people, they think about the next 50 years. This is the Long Clock Foundation. It has been funded by Jeff Bezos and Stuart Brand, two important figures in the history of Silicon Valley. And the idea was to give like a representation of time through the next 50 years, which is a very interesting way to see the future. And actually, other people think about in Silicon Valley of the next 500 years. If you listen, if you pay attention really to what Elon Musk say, that's exactly his conclusion. He say, we have to think about the next 50-100 years. And from that regard, it's clearly, it's super clear, crystal clear that we will be surrounded by robots. We will live partly in Mars. And we have in the brain some computer interface. And to me, it's a real, the best epitome of William Gibson, the writer I mentioned earlier, was saying in the 90s, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And I think it's problematic, I think that it's unfair, and I think that we need a more evenly distributed future. Thank you so much.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijašević. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.